Hello and welcome to Required Reading, the podcast that revisits the most impactful books from our childhood. I'm your host, Erin Bowles. I am a writer, actor, and comedian. You may know me from Welcome to Flatch. Our guest today, oh my goodness, is Paul Feig. Paul is a DGA winning and Emmy nominated filmmaker, writer, producer, and author. His upcoming film, The Housemaid, will be released theatrically by Lionsgate on December 19th, 2025. You may know him from Bridesmaids, The Heat, Spy, A Simple Favor, Freaks and Geeks, and more. And on top of it all, he created the award-winning gin brand, Ardingsalls. He's one of the people I admire most in the world. Please welcome Paul Feig.
Thank
Hello!
you, Aaron. Thank you. My gosh, it's so good to see you.
Oh my goodness! And the book you chose, what a time to read this. What a treat to read this. Frankenstein by Mary Shelley.
Yes, I know. It's such an amazing book. And I have to admit, I did not read this early in life. I actually read this more, in the last couple of decades, and it really affected me. I mean, my favorite book was always A Catcher in the Rye, because like any disaffected teen, that's the one I really responded to. But in a weird way, I feel the parallel between Frankenstein and this, because it's ultimately about disaffected people. And I grew up watching the movies, seeing Frankenstein, A Bride of Frankenstein, and Son of Frankenstein, all those things, and I really loved those. So when I picked up the book finally to read it, I was so flabbergasted at how it's not the movie. It's
Absolutely.
got elements of the book in there, but well, I mean, first of all, it starts out you're in like the Antarctic. And it's some letter from somebody writing and to home, and I'm like, is this friend? Did they put the wrong cover on this book? And then you find out, yeah, that they see somebody being pursued through the Antarctic by somebody else, and that's kind of kicks it off in this amazing way. Had you read the book before?
I had read it once a couple years ago, and I don't know, it like didn't stick in my head at all. It was like I was reading it too fast or something, or just so this time I sat down and I was like, it's such a good time to actually do it the right way and sit down and parse through each line. And so and of course I think in talking about this opportunity, you mentioned the movie that's coming out in from t the day of recording 10 days from today, which I mean you mentioned the movies I think are such a huge part of talking about this book as well.
I think that's, why it landed on me so hard, is coming to it thinking that it was going to be different than what it was, and then really kind of taking the time to be surprised by the contrast and what was taken from the book for the movie, and just how, at its core, it's the same thing, but it's just so much different. And it's much more unsettling. Look, I love the movies. They're two of my favorite. The first two are two of my favorite movies of all time. So it was very odd to see how much more, it's not steampunk, it's almost like Victorian body horror, And the
Definitely.
way, yeah, and the way that it, that that Frankenstein is created by the monsters created by Dr. Frankenstein is so much more chemical, and he finds these body parts, puts them together, and it's all these chemicals going in to this that reanimated, which is so crazy.
Yeah, I also grew up just with the cultural image. It's on everything on Halloween. I don't think I watched any of the movies until I was in college. But when I was going through it this time, I was like, there's actually no mention of electricity at all in the building of him. There's no mention of lightning until when they're like reunited for the first time, Frankenstein and the creature back in Geneva. So it's so interesting how this, I mean, just the cultural presence and reputation of not only the character, but the novel and the movies. And also, I wanted to ask, there's sort of a legend around the creation of the story. Were you aware of that at all, of Mary Shelley and Percy Bysshe Shelley and Byron?
Little bits of it, yeah. I mean, they had their little group and stuff, and she was kind of considered to be, oh, aren't you cute, And she was pretty young. I mean, was she a full-on teenager when she wrote this?
She was, oh, I have it written down, 18 or 19, yes. But she was also, I think, already had two children, and they had already been together for, at the time, they had not, she and Percy Bysshe Shelley had not married yet. They married, I think, like 6 months later, because he had, it's all very, very messy. There was a wife already and lots of things going on.
It's the only the Victorians could do,
Oh my
exactly.
goodness. Well, and Mary Shelley is such a fascinating character because, and she is the daughter of William Godwin and Mary Wollstonecraft, who are two literary and philosophical giants.
Yeah.
And
Now, were they Victorian or were they Edwardian? What period was that, actually? I'm mixing it up.
Mary Shelley was born 1797. So
Oh, that
I
might not be
think,
everything.
yeah,
Yeah.
it's, I mean, it's in the mix. I think it's
Elizabethan? Yeah.
Victorian. I
I'm
think
not up
it's
on my
Victorian.
I lived there for many years, but I am not up on their history, sadly. So I any of our UK listeners, please, I apologize for my idiocy. It's very interesting that end of teens teen would write this
Yeah.
because, it's so kind of in the pocket of I don't know when you're 18 or 19 and have two kids. I don't know if you really call you a teen anymore, but I guess you are. I mean, still,
Yeah.
chemically.
Yeah. Well, and she, her, I've been listening to an audiobook about her life story in the last like week or so. And I only got to, like, she's like 10 in the audiobook. So I didn't, I only did so much. But her life is really fascinating, and it is like she runs away with Shelley at 16. She has her first child at maybe 17, who only lives a couple weeks, and then she has her second child, who th this is a detail that I just don't know what to do with. First off, the book is dedicated to her father, William Godwin. Her mother dies when she's 11 days old, so it's just her father William, and then the young Frankenstein, not the movie, but the younger brother William is named William, and he's the first to die. And her son, who was only a couple months old at the time that she writes this, was also named William, and he would later die as a child. So that aspect is so, I don't know what to do with that knowledge.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess it all adds into the weird maturity that she had. Because I mean, it's a very mature book, just because, I mean, for people who haven't read it, it just the first half is obviously about seeing how he gets the idea, Frankenstein himself, the doctor, gets the idea to do this, does it. What I find so kind of hilariously weird is how depleted he is from it. Like, he has to take to his bed for, I think, 6 months or something after it.
Yes.
He's just comes out like a wreck out of this thing when he creates this thing that just sort of globally kind of moves on the table. And it's almost like he put his entire life force into this thing, which I find very, I mean, maybe it's for the time there was, I feel like some of those old books is people are always taking to their beds and they're
Yes.
like falling apart for months at a time. So maybe that's how you dealt with stuff back then. But
He does spend a good chunk of the book in bed multiple times, and it's when you're reading it, it is so vivid. And then when I would sort of step out and, look through my notes and stuff, it's like this guy is just in and out of bed. He becomes at a distance really sort of a comic character, but he does have one of those, I love in any piece of storytelling, the moment where you get what you want and you don't want it anymore. And I think this is the most quintessential embodiment of that moment.
Oh, 100%. I mean, honestly, I mean, this could not be a more timely book. I mean, with AI coming in, that's, to me, it's just,
Yes.
that's my terror is, we've just created the monster that's going to destroy us all, which I'm utterly convinced will happen, but let's see how long it takes. But so then that happens, and then we switch all of a sudden to the creature, to the monster's point of view, who is this extremely erudite, well thought, deep thinking, beast, but he's like the most civilized man you've ever read, who just happens to be the most horrendous looking, creature in the world. And that is his great sadness, is that
Yeah.
he wants to be everybody's friend and people are running in terror from him, which that gets into your teenage angst right there. So
Exactly.
that's why I'm like, sure, I could have written this a really bad version of this when I was 15 years old. They wouldn't have not had
Exactly.
any staying power.
Well, you mentioned Catcher in the Rye right when we started. They are so similar. This is I don't have the full quote in front of me, but obviously the Del Toro film was coming out, and there is a Del Toro quote that I dug up that's like, this is the quintessential teen novel about feeling lonely and out of place and you don't belong and you feel your body is a stranger to you. Yes.
I think you sent it to me. I can read it here.
That'd be
Says it's a
wonderful.
it's the quintessential sense of isolation you have as a kid. It's the quintessential teenage book. You don't belong. You were brought into this world by people that don't care for you, and you are thrown into a world of pain and suffering and tears and hunger, and you learn to talk. It's an amazing book written by a teenage girl. And that
Exactly.
says it all right there.
I was driving home from, I have a part-time job that I was at this morning, and as I was pulling in, the very last little bit of the audiobook that I heard is Mary Shelley at when she was like 13 or something, was dealing with eczema really badly. And I was
No.
like, what a part of teenagerhood and adolescence is your body absolutely revolting against you and you don't know how to control it. But it is such a It feels like the monster or the creature in this book could not be further from the film adaptations, like you were saying. He is a scholar.
You know, and I know that I honestly didn't see the one that Robert De Niro starred in, but I know they tried to go that way. And I think audiences are like, what? You know, because you want to see, walking around like that. And that's why I'm fascinated to see what Del Toro did, because I'm sure he's going to try to be true to the book. But I'm just interested because it's a weird, like, even as a lover of the whole, all stuff Frankenstein, when you start reading that book, when you get to the monster, you really slam on the brakes because you're like, wait. Who am I? Who's talking right now? And then that's the fun to go like, oh God, the brain inside this thing is so much smarter than everybody else.
Reading those passages because the book is, I mean, a beautiful, crisp three-act structure, and the second act is devoted to the monster's story, and every page is heartbreaking because he's completely new in this world, and every, adjective is frightening and scary, and those words again and again. There's even a moment where he experiences autumn for the first time. He experiences spring, and then he doesn't know autumn is coming. What a heartbreak. It's devastating.
Very much so. And just, staying in that shed that the family is, wanting to be part of that family, and everybody wants to kill him all of a sudden. It's really heartbreaking is the right word. And then his whole thing is like, make me a mate and I will leave you alone.
And the great question is like, will he? Will it happen? Will it work? And I kept getting so stuck on the ending in this reading of it because Frankenstein is on this ship with this sailor. He is on his final deathbed. It's telling this story, and they are trapped in the ice. And the crew members come to the captain and they say, when the ice melts, we want to go home. We want to go to London. And the captain wants to continue. And Frankenstein says, like, don't you dare give up on this mission. You must continue going. But don't do any of the stuff I did. But you must keep pursuing ambition. And so that was the moment I was like, oh, has he learned nothing in that little moment?
Very much so. That's a great point. And also just he's such kind of a whiny little character at the end of the day, because he won't make the spouse, make a partner for this. It's like, you're just like, just do it. If you got to go back to bed for 6 months, just help this guy out, But I guess to him, it's just a monster. It's the way that they communicate is sometimes confusing and frustrating, because you're kind of like, just help the guy out. It's your fault. You created him.
There are so many moments where you want to shake Frankenstein. There's even, I was noticing moments where he's in the first third before the monster is created, he'll say, like, and if only my dad hadn't said that one thing to me, none of this would have happened. And if only this professor hadn't said that, none of this would have happened. He is, I mean, I think by the end of the book, he's about 30, but he is such a teen.
Well, it's a total teen character. Everybody sucks. If it wasn't for them.
And he assumes that he'll be able to protect the people around him, and of course he is unable to. Of course, his cousin wife Elizabeth is killed on their wedding night, and you as the reader are like, guy, you could have stopped this.
Exactly. Well, I mean, and it's, you know, I'm fascinated to being a movie guy.
Yes.
You know, once I read them after seeing the movie, you know, the stuff we go through to adapt, you know, I've adapted or been involved with adaptations of books into movies. And there's so much stuff that works in books that audiences go like, you know, kind of can't take. And I can see the first thing being like, okay, we got to beef up this Dr. Frankenstein character because audiences are just going to want, you know, are just going to walk out of the theater in the frustration. So, you know, that's why, you know, what's his name? Colin, the actor who plays Dr. Frankenstein in the movies. I find him very funny because he's so dramatic and overwrought and stuff, but he's so driven and so, you know, positive about doing all this stuff that, you know, that's clearly the leap they had to make it work. And then, you know, Frankenstein, I can see why you go, okay, suddenly Boris Karloff starts, you know, talking in prose, then the audience won't get it. But also, you know, what's so fascinating about so many of the early monster movies and horror movies is they were made by gay men and written by gay men. And it was so much about that feeling of like, I'm the outsider, I'm the weirdo, you know. And so I think that's why so much got channeled into, you know, the monster who is trying to be accepted, who can't. So it's a very interesting parallel. And you know, James Whale was, you know, such a fascinating filmmaker because of that.
But speaking of, like, how obviously this narrative has been with you throughout time, how do you think this, from the movies when you're young to eventually reading the book, how do you think this sort of has shaped you as a creator throughout time?
Well, I mean, everything I do is based on the lead character being an underdog, being, you know, an outsider, being somebody who can't figure out their place in the world, who feels like, you know, nobody gets them, and then they are able to hopefully overcome that. And, you know, the first thing I created was successfully was Freaks and Geeks, you know, and that's the ultimate. That was just starring a bunch of Frankensteins, basically, you know, stuck in this place. You know, high school is just this kind of prison that the only reason you're all stuck in there together is because you grew up in the same neighborhood, and, you know, that's the only connection you have to everybody else. So it's just a total shit show of different levels of maturity and, you know, different personalities and levels of bullying and victimhood and all that. So, you know, so yeah, so I think that's why I always responded to it. And especially Bride of Frankenstein, which is, I think, one of my top five movies of all time. And it's nuts. I mean, it's banana. It's hilarious. First of all, it starts with Mary Shelley and Byron, and they're like, tell us a story, you know, which is kind of hilarious. You know, I think the instincts in that movie are so funny. And one of my favorite characters of all time in all movies is Dr. Pretorius, who is the mad scientist who shows up to get Colin, I can't remember his last name, the actor, but, you know, get Dr. Frankenstein back into the lab. You know, but one of the first things he shows off is he's learned how to miniaturize, grow miniature people. And it's got this weird sequence of like the little king here. And then he's got a little, I don't know, ballet dancer and stuff. And you're just like, this movie's nuts, but you just kind of go along with it. And it's, but he, they really made, and I don't know if this was a Karloff note or whatever, made Frankenstein much more sympathetic in that one, because that one he's desperately trying to find a friend, and he goes and finds the blind man, and, you know, and all that. And then, you know, when he finally gets his bridesmaid, she hates him, you know, which is kind of great. I remember you had posted some funny tweet years ago about like the Bride of Frankenstein, the titular character doesn't show up until the very end.
Oh gosh,
And yet, the greatest use of screen time ever. I mean, Elsa Lancaster, that's just one of the greatest characters ever. And just that, the way she's acting and she's looking around like a bird and her head's moving really fast. And yeah, it's spectacular.
And Elsa Lancaster, I feel like, shows up so much as a comedian. I think that I wrote a horror movie a year or two ago, and the line between horror and comedy is barely there. Sometimes it's just music is the only difference, and you've been able to navigate both of those spaces. The image of Frankenstein starting to talk is hysterical, and yet heartbreaking.
Totally. Well, you know, I mean, it's an interesting, because I'm very into this of late, which is the that horror and comedy are almost the same thing. And you know what a lot of people don't realize about most horror from the early days on is 90% of it, the people who are making it are laughing the entire time. They are in the editing room cracking up because we're manipulating you so hard, but we're also have that fine line of like, we're scaring the shit out of you and you're laughing because you go, that's so ridiculous. I mean, I don't know if you saw Weapons that came out recently.
Oh my God. Miraculous.
Fantastic.
Miraculous.
I mean, starts out, you're like scared. And then by the end, I'm howling when those kids are chasing her through all those houses. And it's so funny. But Craiger, the director, is a comedy guy.
Yeah.
And I think many of us in comedy are now getting much more enamored with doing thrillers or horror or, you know, things that are high stakes and dangerous because the comedy is not frivolous. It's getting you in the heart and scaring you and affecting you in ways that we try to get comedy to do, but then it's only, you know. Look, I mean, like Bridesmaids is a straight up comedy, even though it's got a lot of, you know, emotional core to it. But still, you know, you're kind of only as good as your jokes in a lot of comedy versus the higher the stakes get. And we had pretty high stakes with this friendship that you're rooting for.
Right.
But when there's actual physical danger, then that kind of takes it to the next level.
That's true. I recently did a little live reading of Three Little Horror Scripts, and mine was the only straight horror, no comedy. And I prefaced it as a joke saying, like, no laughing. And then later someone came up to me and was like, no, there was a funny line in there. There was funniness in there. Oops.
Put together. Well, no, but horror and stuff it's the comedy of extremism. You know, the characters are usually more fun when they have an extreme angle to them or an extreme personality. And then the situations you're going into are so extreme. And it's the laughs. I mean, it's like, you know, I always say when, you know, if you see two people like run into traffic and almost get hit by cars and they get the other side, they'll always look at each other and laugh. You know, like, oh, wow, we lived, you know, and that's such like a natural thing. Like in a horror movie, you scream and then everybody kind of laughs because they look at you like, wow, we fell for that. Then if the filmmaker then gives you something extra to say like, and it's okay, you can laugh. Mm-hmm. We're not doing parody here, but we're just saying we know this is nuts. So please don't think you have to sit. Because, you know, when I saw Weapons, I was in Palm Springs in a movie theater. There's only two other couples there with me and I was by myself. And they were all very, you know, watching it like they thought it was very serious, especially the end when they're running through and the kids are screaming, they're chasing down the woman and stuff, which is so hilarious. And I'm howling with laughter and they kind of look back at me like, hey, you know, this is serious stuff. I'm like, guys, Tom, trust me. I don't know the filmmaker, but I know he is not intending you to sit there taking this seriously right now.
Oh, my goodness. is the actress's name Amy Madigan?
Amy Madigan. I loved her work. I didn't know it was her until the end credits. And when they said it, I was just like, that was her?
Yeah. It's the best things are the ones that you run out of words for. And that's a performance that you can only sit in and stare.
Mm-hmm. Going down the horror track, did you see Abigail, the movie Abigail?
No, missed it, but
watch it. Rent it. Watch it. It's so much fun because it's, again, it's just so extreme and it's bananas and it just goes nuts at the end. It goes absolutely crazy in a great way. And I think that one, you can tell they know a little bit more that they're kind of being funny, but not in a comedy way. But, you know, look, I'm a maximalist. I like things that just go nuts. And so I get so happy when I see people doing stuff that does that. I mean, I don't think Abigail, was successful, but I know Weapons was very successful, you know, but like the first Megan, you know, that was a hilarious movie. I thought it was great. And I thought it was a really well-structured horror movie too, because it actually had kind of a happy ending, even though it said, question mark at the end. But I like that. I tend to not love horror that's kind of like, everybody dies and life's shit and it's all over.
Exactly.
You know?
There has to be balance. You have to be able to laugh at yourself. That's the essence of everything. And and horror is not excluded from that.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a lesson we should get from everything.
Speaking of lessons, I think coming away from this and that little moment about Frankenstein, sort of, has he learned his lesson at the end? This made me think sort of from a 10th grade English class standpoint, what's the theme? What's the message? And as an artist, and it grew into bigger questions of, does there have to be when I was in school, it was always a theme is not a single word like loneliness. It's a full sentence. It has a beginning, you know. But do you find that to be true? Do you find it to be posing questions? What's the theme of this book? I think it's a very nebulous question.
Yeah, but I think books, that's the power of books, is you could do that. You can be a little more nebulous. You don't have to wrap it up, in a neat little bow. When I was in film school, it was always every movie or script or idea or story you were going to tell had to be able to say blank leads to blank. Hubris leads to, downfall or whatever. But I always found it very hard to put movies into that because I said that only works for tragedies. In a Hollywood movie, like whatever it is leads to a happy ending, So I find that harder to do, but that's what I like about books. And what I like about the ending of Frankenstein is like, look, I gave you a million chances to make this not happen, and you didn't take any of them. So now you must pay the price. And I think that's a very worthy and very current, again, lesson for all of us of like, you can only get rid of so many opportunities to stop something before you lose those opportunities, and then you just have to pay the price. And I have nightly, daily, every time, every 24 hours angst about AI because I know it's developing so at such light speed that it's, they say, they go like, it already solves problems in a different way than humans solve problems. I'm like, well, then we're dead. It's all over.
I had not thought about it that way, but I really like what you said about like Frankenstein has this single-mindedness before and after creating the creature, and that fails, makes him incapable of seeing every opportunity to get out. You have so many opportunities to get off this path of whatever. There are infinite opportunities. You just have to be willing enough to see them. And I think that's such a core thing of Frankenstein is he cannot, he's a very binary thinker, I feel like.
Yeah, but he's also a very selfish thinker, because I think
Absolutely.
he broaches it in, I can't unleash more of this on the world. And yet, if he does, it would stop the problem is. But I think it's more he's going, I can't go through that again. I can't, it almost killed me the first time. But look, it's a very real emotion. I get it. It's why sometimes I don't want to do a sequel to certain movies. The first one almost killed me. Yeah, but I do think it was, he's in self-preservation mode. Again, he is a surly, emo teen, basically, and who's created his own smart bully.
You have not seen this upcoming Frankenstein. You haven't had a,
No, not yet.
I have so many questions. I have heard only good things. I was reading this. Frankenstein has a best friend named Henry Clerval, who I know in some readings people really want to see that relationship as a potential queer reading because when Frankenstein sees him again later, he's ecstatic and effusive with joy. And I did not see on Letterboxd an actor credited with Henry Clerval. Doesn't mean it's not there, but
Might
keeping
not
an eye
be.
on it. Yeah,
Yeah, I'm very
definitely.
curious.
Are there any scenes or moments that you really, really are fingers crossed hoping are going to be there?
I'm just curious how they're going to do the creation of the creature. If they're going to go to the electricity version, if they're going to go the chemical version. I have to think that Del Toro is going to do it, closer to the book, because I'd be fascinated to see. Because I know that Maggie Gyllenhaal just is doing The Bride, which is coming out, which is that kind of 1920s-ish kind of thing. But I saw, stills in the trailer, and it's got a lot of stuff with like a lot of tubes going into her. So I was like, oh, I wonder. I get the feeling they're kind of going that route too. So maybe that's going to be everybody's going to do that. No, it's not as cinematic as sparks flying and lightning hitting things, going up at towers and all that. But yeah, but I'm very curious about that. And I'm just curious how he's going to handle the creature. Is the creature going to talk? Will it be intelligent in that way? And if it is, how do you do it where audience is going to be like, what? Because I always go back to, it's funny, there's like movies for movie people and there's movies for everybody else.
Oh my
And
goodness.
movie people are always like, this is so brilliant. And then like a normal person sees like, that's the stupidest thing I ever saw. Like there's, I don't know if you ever saw this movie, it's called Rumblefish. It was something that Francis Ford Coppola
No.
directed. Oh my God, it's one of my favorite movies of all time. It was the sequel to The Outsiders.
Okay.
written by the same author. I can't remember the name of that author. It's two letters.
S.E. Hinton?
Yes, that's it. S.E. Hinton. Thank you. See, I knew you would do that. Hey, but it's shot in black and white. It's the first soundtrack that that Stuart Copeland from The Police ever did. And it's beautiful, but it's very impressionistic. And like at one point, Matt Dillon's character like gets hit or something, and he passes out. And then like you suddenly he starts to float, and he's floating around, floating over his town. And we are all in film school. We're like, oh my God, it's so beautiful! I can't believe it. And then I went back to Michigan for Christmas, and my next door neighbors—they're a little younger than me—and they came back. We just saw the stupidest movie. He gets hit in the head. He starts to fly. It was so stupid. And they're all laughing. I'm like, hey, you guys, you don't realize. And then I was like, okay, maybe let's make movies that aren't quite so for film people. Let's just entertain an
Yes.
audience.
Oh, I saw Megalopolis last year with my boyfriend and his brother and sister-in-law and his sister and her partner, the six of us. Everyone walked out with a very different reaction. It was
That I can
very,
imagine.
very
Well,
comedic.
there's a documentary coming up by the making of it, so I'm excited to see
Hell yeah. Oh
that.
gosh. But I love this book. This was such a treat to reread, and it's so fascinating. I think looking at it is such a, it feels like this novel could only have been written in 1818. There is such a convalescence of incredible things. The reason that they are on this vacation and cannot go, it's June when they have this special fireside chat or whatever, is because the year before, in 1815, a volcano in Indonesia went off and created across Europe the year without summer because there was so much crud in the sky. So they couldn't go outside that day. And it's, and there's electricity coming out and it all.
Oh, interesting.
And yet every time it gets adapted, this could only be made now. And it speaks so much, like you were saying, to this exact moment. It's
Yeah. Well,
wow.
I'd be curious where like the chemical world was at that time, because I get the
Yes.
feeling that was must have been a big thing, because that feels like it's very inspired by some new discovery that had happened in
Yes.
that way.
Again, listening to this wonderful audiobook, Mary Shelley's mother probably wouldn't have died if the doctor who treated her while she was giving birth had washed his hands.
Oh,
That
wow.
just that much, and she probably would have lived. And yet, 18, 19 years later, you get this, which is all about, which is early science fiction and.
It's a real stunner. You kind of just can't believe that it got written. And
Yeah.
there's very few books that I kind of go, I want to read that again, and it's really just those, it's Catcher in the Rye and Frankenstein. Everyone's always just, I'm just going to pick this up and just read, just go to the
Absolutely.
middle of it and read. And you always find something new and some extra thing that just kind of moves you or makes you go, wow, I can't
Yeah.
believe that was happened.
Yeah. And one more little factoid. It was published anonymously originally.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was, but the it was still dedicated to her father, and it had I think like a preface or something written by her husband. And her husband was a follower of her father, like his political views. So I think when it came out, everyone thought her husband had written it. And then I saw a very quippy article, review that was like, well, we've learned it's written by a woman, and that makes sense because it's so bad. Very
God. There
snippy.
we go. It always comes back to that, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Oh my
Haven't
God.
changed at all.
No, not at all. Oh, poor Mary Shelley. Well, because I'm not honestly not even up on how many other books she wrote.
She wrote a couple more. I think this is thought to be her best, and I think, I mean, you can teach an entire college course on this novel alone, and I am so fascinated just personally and my own stuff and the relationship between her and her mother, how that translates. There are ways that you can read this as is Mary Shelley the creature, and are her parents Frankenstein, and how does that work? So I don't even remember the point I was going to make, but she has
No,
other
I
novels. She has
yes,
other
I, oh,
novels.
that's a good,
She has
excellent,
other
very good,
novels.
nice. I'll have to read them all now.
I know she also was like a travel log writer. She traveled quite a bit. So there's but the I please hold for 1 second while I pull up the wonderful writer of this audio or this biography that I'm
Give
reading.
a shout out because I want to read it now.
She's Miranda Seymour.
Miranda Seymour.
Miranda Seymour, and it's just titled Mary Shelley. And my understanding of it is that Miranda Seymour had access to a number of documents that have like never been accessible before and compiled. This is really a
Wow.
an intense. Highly recommend. I'm only like 10% of the way through.
I'm all over it. I love it already. I'm in.
Yeah.
Well, cool.
That I think is all my notes. Is there anything you know you wanted to talk about that we have not covered?
No, honestly, I mean it's everybody read the book if you haven't read it, and then watch the movie or watch the movie. Actually, watch the movies first and then read the
Yeah.
book because it's kind of fascinating of what got pulled out of. You just see the germ of ideas from the book that ended up getting fleshed out in the movies. Yeah, and I mean, it's not the book, but I think Boris Karloff was that's one of the greatest
Oh my
acting
goodness.
performances ever, and it's just so spot on and wonderful. And that, boy, that first movie is fucking dark too. I mean, when he kills a little girl, you're like,
Yeah.
wow, okay. You think, oh, this is gonna be
Yeah.
sweet, and then like he throws her in the water, drowns
Yeah.
her. Yeah, it's pretty
That,
heavy.
I never thought about it. That's gotta be pre-code. There's no way that's
Oh, 100%. Oh
post-code.
no, my
That's
God.
gotta be pre-code.
Yeah, totally. They probably made them come up with the code, I'm betting. Yeah, the first time you watch it, you go, like, they're not going to really. Oh my God, wow. I thought
Yeah.
movies today were dark, but that one.
Exactly. Oh man.
I just also just love how that movie starts, where the guy comes out and introduces it, and it says you might be very scared and all that
Yes.
stuff. I'm desperate to do that in the front of one of my movies, just to come
Oh,
out and make a disclaimer to
do
everybody
it.
in a top hat and
I
white tie and tails. I'll do it. I will do it.
you. But I end every episode with asking, would you consider this required reading? Whatever required means to you is very, again, very nebulous. Would you
I
consider
would
it required
very,
reading?
very much consider this required reading again because I think this is such a current. If you look at in the with everything we're going through today, all the how many monsters we've created that we've lost control of, be they human or be they AI or be they technology in general or the internet, we keep creating things because we think they'll take us forward. I think they get created a lot because they think they'll make money more than anything. But also people just create stuff because, oh my God, we can create this thing without ever really thinking. But now when once it exists, what's it's going to do and how is it going to affect us positively and or negatively? And usually both with tipped a little more towards negative
Yeah.
sometimes. So yeah, very much required reading and cautionary reading, I would dare say.
Yes. And I again, I love you brought this point of you can always get out, actually. There until the very, 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 very end, or even then, I bet you can find a way out. And that's
Exactly.
almost a hopeful way to read it, which I really
Yes.
love.
There you
Yeah.
go. I know. See, yeah, I know. You always have to give a little bit of hope. A little
Yes.
bit of hope.
And I love it. Just one last. I keep, she's so good. Frankenstein is telling the captain how he did it. And he goes, and I figured out the secret to life, and I'm not going to tell you because you shouldn't have it. And I was like, what a genius move from Mary Shelley of like, I don't actually have to figure out what this is.
Exactly. It was a
Brilliant
bunch of
writer move.
chemicals. It kind of worked, but we're not
Exactly.
going to
Just
tell
trust me on it. Yeah.
you.
Absolutely
And
required reading.
we
Oh my
completely buy
goodness.
it.
Well, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Aaron.
Oh
So
my
much fun.
goodness.
It's a great podcast. I mean,
Thank
really, and
you.
you're just so great. You're a great host. And my God, your research is fantastic. I learned so much today. I came in just kind
Thank
of an
you.
idiot, go like, this book's cool. And now I know so much more.
If there's one thing I love to do, it's research. There's a lot of things I love
Nice.
to do. I have to shake myself and be like, stop writing period pieces because you're using research as a way to procrastinate. And they're not going to be
Well,
easy to produce.
no, there you go. Exactly.
Exactly.
But people love period pieces, I'm telling you,
Oh
especially
my
in
God.
books,
I got them coming out the wazoo.
Yeah.
But obviously, December 19th, The Housemaid comes
Yes.
out.
In theater, only in
Go
theaters.
only in
Yeah.
theaters.
On the big screen, yes,
Oh
and
my
it's fun.
goodness.
It gets a very big response from the audience. Our test screenings have
Oh.
been crazy because like people are
Oh.
like yelling at the screen and laughing and cheering and screaming and it's everything. So it's a lot of fun. There's a
Oh
lot of twists
goodness.
and twists and turns. If you it's based on a book and it's a very best-selling book, but my advice is buy the book, don't read it, watch the movie, and then read the book,
Oh.
because there's so many fun surprises that happen in the movie, and that if you know the book, you'll know they're coming. And I made sure to put in a bunch of stuff. You know, we added things that weren't in the book, just so if you're a book reader, you still have a few surprises and all that. And the performances are just spectacular.
I read it in maybe February or around then, and every page was like, oh my God, what's he gonna do with this? So
It was
excited.
fun. It was fun. And we had a really great writer, Rebecca Sonnenschein, who came in and did the adaptation. And it just, I'm very, very proud of it. So
Oh my
can't wait for
goodness.
you to see it.
Oh, I'll be there with bells on. Oh my goodness.
Yay.
Well, if you feel good, I'm gonna turn off the recording.
I'm good. Thanks, Aaron.
Okay.